the Nazi Party's anthem. On April 6, 1933, the Oberstdorf Fishing Society banned Jews from its ranks. None of the 32 members was Jewish, but they felt they had to prove their Aryan credentials to the new regime. Things were even more extreme in Stalin's USSR. Whereas the Nazis still allowed church organizations and private businesses some partial freedom of action, the Soviets made no exceptions. By 1928 and the launch of the first five-year plan, there were government officials, party functionaries, and secret police informants in every neighborhood and village, and between them, they controlled every aspect of life. All businesses from power plants to cabbage farms, all newspapers and radio stations, all universities, schools and youth groups, all hospitals and clinics, all voluntary and religious organizations, all sporting and scientific associations, all parks, museums and cinemas. If a dozen people came together to play football, hike in the woods or do some charity work, the party and the secret police had to be there too, represented by the local party cell or NKVD agent. The speed and efficiency of modern information technology meant that all these party cells and NKVD agents were always just a telegram or phone call away from Moscow. Information about suspicious persons and activities was fed into a countrywide, cross-referenced system of card catalogues. Known as kartoteki, these catalogues contained information from work records, police files, residence cards, and other forms of social registrations, and, by the 1930s, had become the primary mechanism for surveilling and controlling the Soviet population. This made it feasible for Stalin to seek control over the totality of Soviet life. One crucial example was the campaign to collectivize Soviet farming. For centuries, economic, social, and private life in the thousands of villages of the sprawling Tsarist Empire was managed by several traditional institutions: the local commune, the parish church, the private farm, the local market, and above all, the family. In the mid-1920s, the Soviet Union was still an overwhelmingly agrarian economy. About 82% of the total population lived in villages, and 83% of the workforce was engaged in farming. But if each peasant family made its own decisions about what to grow, what to buy, and how much to charge for their produce, it greatly limited the ability of Moscow officials to themselves plan and control social and economic activities. What if the officials decided on a major agrarian reform, but the peasant families rejected it? So, when in 1928 the Soviets came up with their first five-year plan for the development of the Soviet Union, the most important item on the agenda was to collectivize farming. The idea was that in every village, all the families would join a kolkhoz, a collective farm. They would hand over to the kolkhoz all their property: land, houses, horses, cows, shovels, pitchforks. They would work together for the kolkhoz, and in return, the kolkhoz would provide for all their needs, from housing and education to food and healthcare. The kolkhoz would also decide, based on orders from Moscow, whether they should grow cabbages or turnips, whether to invest in a tractor or a school, and who would work in the dairy farm, the tannery, and the clinic. The result, thought the Moscow masterminds, would be the first perfectly just and equal society in human history. They were similarly convinced of the economic advantages of their proposed system, thinking that the kolkhoz would enjoy economy of scale. For example, when every peasant family had but a small strip of land, it made little sense to buy a tractor to plow it, and in any case, most families couldn't afford a tractor. Once all land was held communally, it could be cultivated far more efficiently using modern machinery. In addition, the kolkhoz was supposed to benefit from the wisdom of modern science. Instead of every peasant deciding on production methods on the basis of old traditions and groundless superstitions, state experts with university degrees from institutions like the Lenin All-Union Academy of Agricultural Sciences would make the crucial decisions. To the planners in Moscow, it sounded wonderful. They expected a 50% increase in agricultural production by 1931, and if in the process the old village hierarchies and inequalities were bulldozed, all the better. To most peasants, however, it sounded terrible. They didn't trust the Moscow planners or the new Kolkhoz system. They did not want to give up their old way of life or their private property. Villagers slaughtered cows and horses instead of handing them to the Kolkhoz. Their motivation to work dwindled. People made less effort ploughing fields that belonged to everyone than ploughing fields that belonged to their own family. Passive resistance was ubiquitous, sometimes flaring into violent clashes. Whereas Soviet planners expected to harvest 98 million tons of grain in 1931, production was only 69 million, according to official data, and might have been as low as 57 million tons in reality. The 1932 harvest was even worse. The state reacted with fury. Between 1929 and 1936, food confiscation, government neglect, and man-made famines, resulting from government policy rather than a natural disaster, claimed the lives of between 4.5 and 8.5 million people. Millions of additional peasants were declared enemies of the state and deported or imprisoned. The most basic institutions of peasant life, the family, the church, the local community, were terrorized and dismantled. In the name of justice, equality, and the will of the people, the collectivization campaign annihilated anything that stood in its way. In the first 2 months of 1930 alone, about 60 million peasants in more than 100,000 villages were herded into collective farms. In June 1929, only 4% of Soviet peasant households had belonged to collective farms. By March 1930, the figure had risen to 57%. By April 1937, 97% of households in the countryside had been confined to the 235,000 Soviet collective farms. In just 7 years, then, a way of life that had existed for centuries had been replaced by the totalitarian brainchild of a few Moscow bureaucrats. The Kulaks. It is worthwhile to delve a little deeper into the history of Soviet collectivization, for it was a tragedy that bears some resemblance to earlier catastrophes in human history, like the European witch hunt craze, and at the same time foreshadows some of the biggest dangers posed by 21st century technology and its faith in supposedly scientific data. When their efforts to collectivize farming encountered resistance and led to economic disaster, Moscow bureaucrats and mythmakers took a page from Kramer's Hammer of the Witches. I don't wish to imply that the Soviets actually read the book, but they too invented a global conspiracy and created an entire non-existent category of enemies. In the 1930s, Soviet authorities repeatedly blamed the disasters afflicting the Soviet economy on a counter-revolutionary cabal whose chief agents were the Kulaks, or capitalist farmers. Just as in Kramer's imagination, witches serving Satan conjured hailstorms that destroyed crops, so in the Stalinist imagination, Kulaks beholden to global capitalism sabotaged the Soviet economy. In theory, kulaks were an objective socio-economic category defined by analyzing empirical data on things like property, income, capital, and wages. Soviet officials could allegedly identify kulaks by counting things. If most people in a village had only one cow, then the few families who had three cows were considered kulaks. If most people in a village didn't hire any labor, but one family hired two workers during harvest time, this was a kulak family. Being a kulak meant not only that you possessed a certain amount of property, but also that you possessed certain personality traits. According to the supposedly infallible Marxist doctrine, people's material conditions determined their social and spiritual character. Since kulaks allegedly engaged in capitalist exploitation, it was a scientific fact, according to Marxist thinking, that they were greedy, selfish, and unreliable, and so were their children. Discovering that someone was a kulak ostensibly revealed something profound about their fundamental nature. On December 27, 1929, Stalin declared that the Soviet state should seek the liquidation of the kulaks as a class, and immediately galvanized the party and the secret police to realize that ambitious and murderous aim. Early modern European witch hunters worked in autocratic societies that lacked modern information technology. Therefore, it took them 3 centuries to kill 50,000 alleged witches. In contrast, Soviet kulak hunters were working in a totalitarian society that had at its disposal technologies such as telegraphs, trains, telephones, and radios, as well as a sprawling bureaucracy. They decided that 2 years would suffice to liquidate millions of kulaks. Soviet officials began by assessing how many kulaks there must be in the USSR. Based on existing data, such as tax records, employment records, and the 1926 Soviet census, they decided that kulaks constituted 3-5% of the rural population. On January 30, 1930, just 1 month after Stalin's speech, a Politburo decree translated his vague vision into a much more detailed plan of action. The decree included target numbers for the liquidation of kulaks in each major agricultural region. Regional authorities then made their own estimates of the number of kulaks in each county under their jurisdiction. Eventually, specific quotas were assigned to rural Soviets, local administrative units typically comprising a handful of villages. Often, local officials inflated the numbers along the way to prove their zeal. Each rural Soviet then had to identify the stated number of kulak households in the villages under its purview. These people were expelled from their homes and, according to the administrative category to which they belonged, resettled elsewhere, incarcerated in concentration camps, or condemned to death. How exactly did Soviet officials tell who was a kulak? In some villages, local party members made a conscientious effort to identify kulaks by objective measures, such as the amount of property they owned. It was often the most hard-working and efficient farmers who were stigmatized and expelled. In some villages, local communists used the opportunity to get rid of their personal enemies. Some villages simply drew lots on who would be considered a kulak. Other villages held communal meetings to vote on the matter, and often chose isolated farmers, widows, old people, and other expendables, exactly the sorts of people who in early modern Europe were most likely to be branded witches. The absurdity of the entire operation is manifested in the case of the Streletsky family from the Kurgan region of Siberia. Dmitry Streletsky, who was then a teenager, recalled years later how his family was branded kulaks and selected for liquidation. Serkov, the chairman of the village Soviet who deported us, explained, "I have received an order from the district party committee to find 17 kulak families for deportation. I formed a committee of the poor and we sat through the night to choose the families. There is no one in the village who is rich enough to qualify, and not many old people, so we simply chose the 17 families. You were chosen. Please don't take it personally. What else could I do?" If anyone dared object to the madness of the system, they were promptly denounced as kulaks and counter-revolutionaries and would themselves be liquidated. Altogether, some 5 million kulaks would be expelled from their homes by 1933. As many as 30,000 heads of households were shot. The more fortunate victims were resettled in their district of origin or became vagrant workers in the big cities, while about 2 million were either exiled to remote, inhospitable regions or incarcerated as state slaves in labor camps. numerous important and notorious state projects, such as the construction of the White Sea Canal and the development of mines in the Arctic regions, were accomplished with the labor of millions of prisoners, many of them kulaks. It was one of the fastest and largest enslavement campaigns in human history. Once branded a kulak, a person could not get rid of the stigma. Government agencies, party organs, and secret police documents recorded who was a kulak in a labyrinthine system of Kartoteki catalogues, archives, and internal passports. Kulak status even passed to the next generation with devastating consequences. Kulak children were refused entrance to communist youth groups, the Red Army, universities, and prestigious areas of employment. In her 1997 memoirs, Antonina Golovina recalled how her family was deported from its ancestral village as kulaks and sent to live in the town of Pestovo. The boys in her new school regularly taunted her. On one occasion, a senior teacher told the 11-year-old Antonina to stand up in front of all the other children and began abusing her mercilessly, shouting that her sort were enemies of the people, wretched kulaks. You certainly deserved to be deported. I hope you're all exterminated. Antonina wrote that this was the defining moment of her life. I had this feeling in my gut that we, kulaks, were different from the rest, that we were criminals. She never got over it. Like the 10-year-old witch Hansel Pappenheimer, the 11-year-old kulak Antonina Golovina found herself cast into an intersubjective category invented by human mythmakers and imposed by ubiquitous bureaucrats. The mountains of information collected by Soviet bureaucrats about the kulaks wasn't the objective truth about them, but it imposed a new intersubjective Soviet truth. Knowing that someone was labeled a kulak was a very important thing to know about a Soviet person, even though the label was entirely bogus. One big happy Soviet family. The Stalinist regime would go on to attempt something even more ambitious than the mass dismantling of private family farms. It set out to dismantle the family itself. Unlike Roman emperors or Russian tsars, Stalin tried to insert himself even into the most intimate human relationships, coming between parents and children. Family ties were considered the bedrock of corruption, inequality, and anti-party activities. Soviet children were therefore taught to worship Stalin as their real father, and to inform on their biological parents if they criticized Stalin or the Communist Party. Starting in 1932, the Soviet propaganda machine created a veritable cult around the figure of Pavlik Morozov, a 13-year-old boy from the Siberian village of Gerasimovka. In autumn 1931, Pavlik informed the secret police that his father, Trofim, the chairman of the village Soviet, was selling false papers to Kulag exiles. During the subsequent trial, when Trofim shouted to Pavlik, "It's me, your father," the boy retorted, "Yes, he used to be my father, but I no longer consider him my father." Trofim was sent to a labor camp and later shot. In September 1932, Pavlik was found murdered, and Soviet authorities arrested and executed five of his family members, who allegedly killed him in revenge for the denunciation. The real story was far more complicated, but it didn't matter to the Soviet press. Pavlik became a martyr, and millions of Soviet children were taught to emulate him. Many did. For example, in 1934, a 13-year-old boy called Pronia Kolibin told the authorities that his hungry mother stole grain from the Kolkhoz fields. His mother was arrested and presumably shot. Pronia was rewarded with a cash prize and a lot of positive media attention. The party organ, Pravda, published a poem Pronia wrote. Two of its lines read, "You are a wrecker, mother. I can live with you no more." The Soviet attempt to control the family was reflected in a dark joke told in Stalin's day. Stalin visits a factory undercover, and conversing with a worker, he asks the man, "Who is your father?" "Stalin," replies the worker. "Who is your mother?" "The Soviet Union," the man responds. "And what do you want to be?" "An orphan." At the time, you could easily lose your liberty or your life for telling this joke, even if you told it in your own home to your closest family members. The most important lesson Soviet parents taught their children wasn't loyalty to the party or to Stalin. It was, keep your mouth shut. Few things in the Soviet Union were as dangerous as holding an open conversation. Party and Church. You may wonder whether modern totalitarian institutions like the Nazi Party or the Soviet Communist Party were really all that different from earlier institutions like the Christian churches. After all, churches too believed in their infallibility, had priestly agents everywhere, and sought to control the daily life of people down to their diet and sexual habits. Shouldn't we see the Catholic Church or the Eastern Orthodox Church as totalitarian institutions? And doesn't this undermine the thesis that totalitarianism was made possible only by modern information technology? There are, however, several major differences between modern totalitarianism and pre-modern churches. First, as noted earlier, modern totalitarianism has worked by deploying several overlapping surveillance mechanisms that keep one another in order. The party is never alone. It works alongside state organs on the one side and the secret police on the other. In contrast, in most medieval European kingdoms, the Catholic Church was an independent institution that often clashed with the state institutions instead of reinforcing them. Consequently, the church was perhaps the most important check on the power of European autocrats. For example, when in the investiture controversy of the 1070s, King Henry IV of Germany and Italy asserted that he had the final say on the appointments of bishops, abbots, and other church officials, Pope Gregory VII mobilized resistance and eventually forced the king to surrender. On January 25, 1077, Henry reached Canossa Castle, where the Pope was lodging, to offer his submission and apology. The Pope refused to open the gates, and Henry waited in the snow outside, barefoot and hungry. After 3 days, the Pope finally opened the gates to the king, who begged forgiveness. An analogous clash in a modern totalitarian country is unthinkable. The whole idea of totalitarianism is to prevent any separation of powers. In the Soviet Union, state and party reinforced each other, and Stalin was the de facto head of both. There could be no Soviet investiture controversy, because Stalin had final say about all appointments to both party positions and state functions. He decided both who would be General Secretary of the Communist Party of Georgia and who would be Foreign Minister of the Soviet Union. Another important difference is that medieval churches tended to be traditionalist organizations that resisted change, while modern totalitarian parties have tended to be revolutionary organizations demanding change. A pre-modern church built its power gradually by developing its structure and traditions over centuries. A king or a pope who wanted to swiftly revolutionize society was therefore likely to encounter stiff resistance from church members and ordinary believers. For example, in the 8th and 9th centuries, a series of Byzantine emperors sought to forbid the veneration of icons, which seemed to them idolatrous. They pointed to many passages in the Bible, most notably the Second Commandment, that forbade making any graven images. While Christian churches traditionally interpreted the Second Commandment in a way that allowed the veneration of icons, emperors like Constantine V argued that this was a mistake and that disasters like Christian defeats by the armies of Islam were due to God's wrath over the worship of icons. In 754, more than 300 bishops assembled in the Council of Hieria to support Constantine's iconoclastic position. Compared with Stalin's collectivization campaign, this was a minor reform. Families and villages were required to give up their icons, but not their private property or their children. Yet Byzantine iconoclasm met with widespread resistance. Unlike the participants in the Council of Hieria, many ordinary priests, monks, and believers were deeply attached to their icons. The resulting struggle ripped apart Byzantine society until the emperors conceded defeat and reversed course. Constantine V was later vilified by Byzantine historians as Constantine the Shitty, Copronymos, and a story was spread about him that he defecated during his baptism. Unlike pre-modern churches, which developed slowly over many centuries and therefore tended to be conservative and suspicious of rapid changes, modern totalitarian parties like the Nazi Party and the Soviet Communist Party were organized within a single generation around the promise to quickly revolutionize society. They didn't have centuries-old traditions and structures to defend. When their leaders conceived some ambitious plan to smash existing traditions and structures, party members typically fell in line. Perhaps most important of all, pre-modern churches could not become tools of totalitarian control because they themselves suffered from the same limitations as all other pre-modern organizations. While they had local agents everywhere, in the shape of parish priests, monks, and itinerant preachers, the difficulty of transmitting and processing information meant that church leaders knew little about what was going on in remote communities, and local priests had a large degree of autonomy. Consequently, churches tended to be local affairs. People in every province and village often venerated local saints, upheld local traditions, performed local rites, and might even have had local doctrinal ideas that differed from the official line. If the Pope in Rome wanted to do something about an independent-minded priest in a remote Polish parish, he had to send a letter to the Archbishop of Gniezno, who had to instruct the relevant bishop, who had to send someone to intervene in the parish. That might take months, and there was ample opportunity for the archbishop, bishop, and other intermediaries to reinterpret or even mislay the Pope's orders. Churches became more totalitarian institutions only in the late modern era, when modern information technologies became available. We tend to think of popes as medieval relics, but actually they are masters of modern technology. In the 18th century, the Pope had little control over the worldwide Catholic Church and was reduced to the status of a local Italian princeling, fighting other Italian powers for control of Bologna or Ferrara. With the advent of radio, the Pope became one of the most powerful people on the planet. Pope John Paul II could sit in the Vatican and speak directly to millions of Catholics from Poland to the Philippines without any archbishop, bishop, or parish priest able to twist or hide his words. How information flows. We see then that the new information technology of the late modern era gave rise to both large-scale democracy and large-scale totalitarianism. But there were crucial differences between how the two systems used information technology. As noted earlier, democracy encourages information to flow through many independent channels rather than only through the center, and it allows many independent nodes to process the information and make decisions by themselves. Information freely circulates between private businesses, private media organizations, municipalities, sports associations, charities, families, and individuals, without ever passing through the office of a government minister. In contrast, totalitarianism wants all information to pass through the central hub and doesn't want any independent institutions making decisions on their own. True, totalitarianism does have its tripartite apparatus of government, party, and secret police. But the whole point of this parallel apparatus is to prevent the emergence of any independent power that might challenge the center. When government officials, party members, and secret police agents constantly keep tabs on one another, opposing the center is extremely dangerous. As contrasting types of information networks, democracy and totalitarianism both have their advantages and disadvantages. The biggest advantage of the centralized totalitarian network is that it is extremely orderly, which means it can make decisions quickly and enforce them ruthlessly. Especially during emergencies like wars and epidemics, centralized networks can move much faster and farther than distributed networks. But hyper-centralized information networks also suffer from several big disadvantages. Since they don't allow information to flow anywhere except through the official channels, if the official channels are blocked, the information cannot find an alternative means of transmission. And official channels are often blocked. One common reason why official channels might be blocked is that fearful subordinates hide bad news from their superiors. In Good Soldier Schweck, a satirical novel about the Austro-Hungarian Empire during World War I, Jaroslav Hašek describes how the Austrian authorities were worried about waning morale among the civilian population. They therefore bombarded local police stations with orders to hire informers, collect data, and report to headquarters on the population's loyalty. To be as scientific as possible, headquarters invented an ingenious loyalty grade. 1A, 1B, 1C, 2A, 2B, 2C, 3A, 3B, 3C, 4A, 4B, 4C. They sent to the local police stations detailed explanations about each grade and an official form that had to be filled out daily. Police sergeants across the country dutifully filled out the forms and sent them back to headquarters. Without exception, all of them always reported a 1A morale level. To do otherwise was to invite rebuke, demotion, or worse. Another common reason why official channels fail to pass on information is to preserve order. Because the chief aim of totalitarian information networks is to produce order rather than discover truth, when alarming information threatens to undermine social order, totalitarian regimes often suppress it. It is relatively easy for them to do so, because they control all the information channels. For example, when the Chernobyl nuclear reactor exploded on April 26, 1986, Soviet authorities suppressed all news of the disaster. Both Soviet citizens and foreign countries were kept oblivious of the danger, and so took no steps to protect themselves from radiation. When some Soviet officials in Chernobyl and the nearby town of Pripyat requested to immediately evacuate nearby population centers, their superiors' chief concern was to avoid the spread of alarming news, so they not only forbade evacuation, but also cut the phone lines and warned employees in the nuclear facility not to talk about the disaster. 2 days after the meltdown, Swedish scientists noticed that radiation levels in Sweden, more than 1,200 kilometers from Chernobyl, were abnormally high. Only after Western governments and the Western press broke the news did the Soviets acknowledge that anything was amiss. Even then, they continued to hide from their own citizens the full magnitude of the catastrophe and hesitated to request advice and assistance from abroad. Millions of people in Ukraine, Belarus, and Russia paid with their health. When the Soviet authorities later investigated the disaster, their priority was to deflect blame rather than understand the causes and prevent future accidents. In 2019, I went on the tour of Chernobyl. The Ukrainian guide who explained what led to the nuclear accident said something that stuck in my mind. "Americans grow up with the idea that questions lead to answers," he said. "But Soviet citizens grew up with the idea that questions lead to trouble." Naturally, leaders of democratic countries also don't relish bad news. But in the distributed democratic network, When official lines of communication are blocked, information flows through alternative channels. For example, if an American official decides against telling the president about an unfolding disaster, that news might nevertheless be published by the Washington Post. And if the Washington Post, too, deliberately withholds the information, the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times will break the story. The business model of independent media, forever chasing the next scoop, all but guarantees publication. When, on March 28, 1979, there was a severe accident in the Three Mile Island nuclear reactor in Pennsylvania, the news quickly spread without any need for international intervention. The accident began around 4 a.m. and was noticed by 6:30 a.m. An emergency was declared in the facility at 6:56, and at 7:02, the accident was reported to the Pennsylvania Emergency Management Agency. During the following hour, the governor of Pennsylvania, the lieutenant governor, and the civil defense authorities were informed. An official press conference was scheduled for 10 a.m. However, a traffic reporter at a local Harrisburg radio station picked up a police notice on events, and the station aired a brief report at 8:25 a.m. In the USSR, such an initiative by an independent radio station was unthinkable, but in the United States it was unremarkable. By 9 a.m., the Associated Press issued a bulletin. Though it took days for the full details to emerge, American citizens learned about the accident 2 hours after it was first noticed. Subsequent investigations by government agencies, NGOs, academics, and the press uncovered not just the immediate causes of the accident, but also its deeper structural causes, which helped improve the safety of nuclear technology worldwide. Indeed, some of the lessons of Three Mile Island, which were openly shared even with the Soviets, contributed to mitigating the Chernobyl disaster. Nobody's perfect. Totalitarian and authoritarian networks face other problems besides blocked arteries. First and foremost, as we have already established, their self-correcting mechanisms tend to be very weak. Since they believe they are infallible, they see little need for such mechanisms. And since they are afraid of any independent institution that might challenge them, they lack free courts, media outlets, or research centers. Consequently, there is nobody to expose and correct the daily abuses of power that characterize all governments. The leader may occasionally proclaim an anti-corruption campaign, but in non-democratic systems, these often turn out to be little more than a smokescreen for one regime faction to purge another faction. And what happens if the leader himself embezzles public funds or makes some disastrous policy mistake? Nobody can challenge the leader, and on his own initiative, the leader, being a human being, may well refuse to admit any mistakes. Instead, he is likely to blame all problems on foreign enemies, internal traitors, or corrupt subordinates, and demand even more power in order to deal with the alleged malefactors. For example, we mentioned in the previous chapter that Stalin adopted the bogus theory of Lysenkoism as the state doctrine on evolution. The results were catastrophic. Neglect of Darwinian models and attempts by Lysenkoist agronomists to create supercrops set back Soviet genetic research for decades and undermined Soviet agriculture. Soviet experts who suggested abandoning Lysenkoism and accepting Darwinism risked the gulag or a bullet to the head. Lysenkoism's legacy haunted Soviet science and agronomy for decades and was one reason why by the early 1970s, the USSR ceased to be a major exporter of grain and became a net importer, despite its vast, fertile lands. The same dynamic characterized many other fields of activity. For instance, during the 1930s, Soviet industry suffered from numerous accidents. This was largely the fault of the Soviet bosses in Moscow, who set up almost impossible goals for industrialization and viewed any failure to achieve them as treason. In the effort to fulfill the ambitious goals, safety measures and quality control checks were abandoned, and experts who advised prudence were often reprimanded or shot. The result was a wave of industrial accidents, dysfunctional products, and wasted efforts. Instead of taking responsibility, Moscow concluded that this must be the handiwork of the global Trotskyite imperialist conspiracy of saboteurs and terrorists bent on derailing the Soviet enterprise. Rather than slow down and adopt safety regulations, the bosses redoubled the terror and shot more people. A famous case in point was Pavel Rychagov. He was one of the best and bravest Soviet pilots, leading missions to help the Republicans in the Spanish Civil War and the Chinese against the Japanese invasion. He quickly rose through the ranks, becoming commander of the Soviet Air Force in August 1940, at age 29. But the courage that helped Rychagov shoot down Nazi airplanes in Spain landed him in deep trouble in Moscow. The Soviet Air Force suffered from numerous accidents, which the Politburo blamed on lack of discipline and deliberate sabotage by anti-Soviet conspiracies. Rychagov, however, wouldn't buy this official line. As a frontline pilot, he knew the truth. He flatly told Stalin that pilots were being forced to operate hastily designed and badly produced airplanes, which he compared to flying in coffins. 2 days after Hitler invaded the Soviet Union, as the Red Army was collapsing and Stalin was desperately hunting for scapegoats, Rychagov was arrested for being a member of an anti-Soviet conspiratorial organization and carrying out enemy work aimed at weakening the power of the Red Army. His wife was also arrested because she allegedly knew about his Trotskyist ties with the military conspirators. They were executed on October 28, 1941. The real saboteur who wrecked Soviet military efforts wasn't Rychagov, of course, but Stalin himself. For years, Stalin feared that a clash to the death with Nazi Germany was likely and built the world's biggest war machine to prepare for it. But he hamstrung this machine both diplomatically and psychologically. On the diplomatic level, in 1939-41, Stalin gambled that he could goad the capitalists to fight and exhaust one another while the USSR nurtured and even increased its power. He therefore made a pact with Hitler in 1939 and allowed the Germans to conquer much of Poland and Western Europe while the USSR attacked or alienated almost all its neighbors. In 1939-40, the Soviets invaded and occupied eastern Poland, annexed Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, and conquered parts of Finland and Romania. Finland and Romania, which could have acted as neutral buffers on the USSR's flanks, consequently became implacable enemies. Even in the spring of 1941, Stalin still refused to make a preemptive alliance with Britain and made no move to hinder the Nazi conquest of Yugoslavia and Greece, thereby losing his last potential allies on the European continent. When Hitler struck on June 22, 1941, the USSR was isolated. In theory, the war machine Stalin built could have handled the Nazi onslaught even in isolation. The territories conquered since 1939 provided depth to Soviet defenses, and the Soviet military advantage seemed overwhelming. On the first day of the invasion, the Soviets had 15,000 tanks, 15,000 warplanes, and 37,000 artillery pieces on the European front, facing 3,300 German tanks, 2,250 warplanes, and 7,146 guns. But in one of history's greatest military catastrophes, within a month, the Soviets lost 11,700 tanks, 78%, 10,000 warplanes, 67%, and 19,000 artillery pieces, 51%. Stalin also lost all the territories he had conquered in 1939-40 and much of the Soviet heartland. By July 16, the Germans were in Smolensk, 370 kilometers from Moscow. The causes of the debacle have been debated ever since 1941, but most scholars agree that a significant factor was the psychological costs of Stalinism. For years, the regime terrorized its people, punished initiative and individuality, and encouraged submissiveness and conformity. This undermined the soldiers' motivation. Especially in the first months of the war, before the horrors of Nazi rule were fully realized, Red Army soldiers surrendered in huge numbers. Between 3 and 4 million were taken captive by the end of 1941. Even when they fought tenaciously, Red Army units suffered from a lack of initiative. Officers who had survived the purges were fearful to take independent actions, while younger officers often lacked adequate training. Frequently starved of information and scapegoated for failures, commanders also had to cope with political commissars who could dispute their decisions. The safest course was to wait for orders from on high and then slavishly follow them even when they made little military sense. Despite the disasters of 1941 and of the spring and summer of 1942, the Soviet state did not collapse, as Hitler hoped. As the Red Army and the Soviet leadership assimilated the lessons learned from the first year of struggle, the political center in Moscow loosened its hold. The power of political commissars was restricted, while professional officers were encouraged to assume greater responsibility and take more initiative. Stalin also reversed his geopolitical mistakes of 1939-41 and allied the USSR with Britain and the United States. Red Army initiative, Western assistance, and the realization of what Nazi rule would mean for the people of the USSR turned the tide of the war. Once victory was secured in 1945, however, Stalin initiated new waves of terror, purging more independent-minded officers and officials and again encouraging blind obedience. Ironically, Stalin's own death 8 years later was partly the result of an information network that prioritized order and disregarded truth. In 1951-53, the USSR experienced yet another witch hunt. Soviet mythmakers fabricated a conspiracy theory that Jewish doctors were systematically murdering leading regime members under the guise of giving them medical care. The theory alleged that the doctors were the agents of a global American Zionist plot working in collaboration with traitors in the secret police. By early 1953, hundreds of doctors and secret police officials, including the head of the secret police himself, were arrested, tortured, and forced to name accomplices. The conspiracy theory, a Soviet twist on the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, merged with age-old blood libel accusations, and rumors began circulating that Jewish doctors were not just murdering Soviet leaders, but also killing babies in hospitals. Since a large proportion of Soviet doctors were Jews, people began fearing doctors in general. Just as the hysteria about the doctors' plot was reaching its climax, Stalin had a stroke on March 1, 1953. He collapsed in his dacha, wet himself, and lay for hours in his soiled pajamas, unable to call for help. At around 10:30 p.m., a guard found the courage to enter the inner sanctum of world communism, where he discovered the leader on the floor. By 3 a.m., on March 2, Politburo members arrived at the dacha and debated what to do. For several hours more, nobody dared call a doctor. What if Stalin were to regain consciousness and open his eyes only to see a doctor, hovering over his bed? He would surely think this was a plot to murder him and would have those responsible shot. Stalin's personal physician wasn't present because he was at the time in a basement cell of the Lubyanka prison, undergoing torture for suggesting that Stalin needed more rest. By the time the Politburo members decided to bring in medical experts, the danger had passed. Stalin never woke up. You may conclude from this litany of disasters that the Stalinist system was totally dysfunctional. Its ruthless disregard for truth caused it not only to inflict terrible suffering on hundreds of millions of people, but also to make colossal diplomatic, military, and economic errors, and to devour its own leaders. However, such a conclusion would be misleading. In the discussion of the abysmal failure of Stalinism in the early phase of World War II, two points complicate the narrative. First, democratic countries like France, Norway, and the Netherlands made at the time diplomatic errors as great as those of the USSR, and their armies performed even worse. Second, the military machine that crushed the Red Army, the French Army, the Dutch Army, and numerous other armies was itself built by a totalitarian regime. So, whatever conclusion we draw from the years 1939 to 41, it cannot be that totalitarian networks necessarily function worse than democratic ones. The history of Stalinism reveals many potential drawbacks of totalitarian information networks, but that should not blind us to their potential advantages. When one considers the broader history of World War II and its outcome, it becomes evident that Stalinism was in fact one of the most successful political systems ever devised, if we define success purely in terms of order and power, while disregarding all considerations of ethics and human well-being. Despite, or perhaps because of, its utter lack of compassion and its callous attitude to truth, Stalinism was singularly efficient at maintaining order on a gigantic scale. The relentless barrage of fake news and conspiracy theories helped to keep hundreds of millions of people in line. The collectivization of Soviet agriculture led to mass enslavement and starvation, but also laid the foundations for the country's rapid industrialization. Soviet disregard for quality control might have produced flying coffins, but it produced them in the tens of thousands, making up in quantity for what they lacked in quality. The decimation of Red Army officers during the Great Terror was a major reason for the army's abysmal performance in 1941, but it was also a key reason why, despite the terrible defeats, nobody rebelled against Stalin. The Soviet military machine tended to crush its own soldiers alongside the enemy, but it eventually rumbled on to victory. In the 1940s and early 1950s, many people throughout the world believed Stalinism was the wave of the future. It had won World War II, after all, raised the red flag over the Reichstag, ruled an empire that stretched from Central Europe to the Pacific, fueled anti-colonial struggles throughout the world, and inspired numerous copycat regimes. It won admirers even among leading artists and thinkers in Western democracies, who believed that notwithstanding the vague rumors about gulags and purges, Stalinism was humanity's best shot at ending capitalist exploitation and creating a perfectly just society. Stalinism thus got close to world domination. It would be naive to assume that its disregard for truth doomed it to failure, or that its ultimate collapse guarantees that such a system can never again arise. Information systems can reach far with just a little truth and a lot of order. Anyone who abhors the moral costs of systems like Stalinism cannot rely on their supposed inefficiency to derail them. The technological pendulum. Once we learn to see democracy and totalitarianism as different types of information networks, we can understand why they flourish in certain eras and are absent in others. It is not just because people gain or lose faith in certain political ideals, it is also because of revolutions in information technologies. Of course, just as the printing press didn't cause the witch hunts or the scientific revolution, so radio didn't cause either Stalinist totalitarianism or American democracy. Technology only creates new opportunities. it is up to us to decide which ones to pursue. Totalitarian regimes choose to use modern information technology to centralize the flow of information and to stifle truth in order to maintain order. As a consequence, they have to struggle with the danger of ossification. When more and more information flows to only one place, will it result in efficient control or in blocked arteries and, finally, a heart attack? Democratic regimes choose to use modern information technology to distribute the flow of information between more institutions and individuals and encourage the free pursuit of truth. They consequently have to struggle with the danger of fracturing. Like a solar system with more and more planets circling faster and faster, can the center still hold, or will things fall apart and anarchy prevail? An archetypal example of the different strategies can be found in the contrasting histories of Western democracies and the Soviet bloc in the 1960s. This was an era when Western democracies relaxed censorship and various discriminatory policies that hampered the free spread of information. This made it easier for previously marginalized groups to organize, join the public conversation, and make political demands. The resulting wave of activism destabilized the social order. Hitherto, when the limited number of rich white men did almost all the talking, it was relatively easy to reach agreements. Once poor people, women, LGBTQ people, ethnic minorities, disabled people, and members of other historically oppressed groups gained a voice, they brought with them new ideas, opinions, and interests. Many of the old gentlemanly agreements consequently became untenable. For example, the Jim Crow segregation regime, upheld or at least tolerated by generations of both Democratic and Republican administrations in the United States, fell apart. Things that were considered sacrosanct, self-evident, and universally accepted, such as gender roles, became deeply controversial, and it was difficult to reach new agreements because there were many more groups, viewpoints, and interests to take into account. Just holding an orderly conversation was a challenge because people couldn't even agree on the rules of debate. This caused much frustration among both the old guard and the freshly empowered, who suspected that their newfound freedom of expression was hollow and that their political demands were not fulfilled. Disappointed with words, some switched to guns. In many Western democracies, the 1960s were characterized not just by unprecedented disagreements, but also by a surge of violence. Political assassinations, kidnappings, riots, and terror attacks multiplied. The murders of John F. Kennedy and Martin Luther King Jr., the riots following King's assassination, and the wave of demonstrations, revolts, and armed clashes that swept the Western world in 1968 were just some of the more famous examples. The images from Chicago or Paris in 1968 could easily have given the impression that things were falling apart. The pressure to live up to the democratic ideals and to include more people and groups in the public conversation seemed to undermine the social order and to make democracy unworkable. Meanwhile, the regimes behind the Iron Curtain, which never promised inclusivity, continued stifling the public conversation and centralizing information and power. And it seemed to work. Though they did face some peripheral challenges, most notably the Hungarian Revolt of 1956 and the Prague Spring of 1968, the communists dealt with these threats swiftly and decisively. In the Soviet heartland itself, everything was orderly. Fast forward 20 years, and it was the Soviet system that had become unworkable. The sclerotic gerontocrats on the podium in Red Square were a perfect emblem of a dysfunctional information network, lacking any meaningful self-correcting mechanisms. Decolonization, globalization, technological development, and changing gender roles led to rapid economic, social, and geopolitical changes. But the gerontocrats could not handle all the information streaming to Moscow. and since no subordinate was allowed much initiative, the entire system ossified and collapsed. The failure was most obvious in the economic sphere. The over-centralized Soviet economy was slow to react to rapid technological developments and changing consumer wishes. Obeying commands from the top, the Soviet economy was churning out intercontinental missiles, fighter jets, and prestige infrastructure projects. But it was not producing what most people actually wanted to buy, from efficient refrigerators to pop music, and lagged behind in cutting-edge military technology. Nowhere were its shortcomings more glaring than in the semiconductor sector, in which technology developed at a particularly fast rate. In the West, semiconductors were developed through open competition between numerous private companies like Intel and Toshiba, whose main customers were other private companies like Apple and Sony. The latter used microchips to produce civilian goods such as the Macintosh personal computer and the Walkman. The Soviets could never catch up with American and Japanese microchip production because, as the American economic historian Chris Miller explained, the Soviet semiconductor sector was secretive, top-down, oriented toward military systems, fulfilling orders with little scope for creativity. The Soviets tried to close the gap by stealing and copying Western technology, which only guaranteed that they always remained several years behind. Thus, the first Soviet personal computer appeared only in 1984, at a time when in the United States, people already had 11 million PCs. Western democracies not only surged ahead technologically and economically, but also succeeded in holding the social order together, despite, or perhaps because of, widening the circle of participants in the political conversation. There were many hiccups, but the United States, Japan, and other democracies created a far more dynamic and inclusive information system, which made room for many more viewpoints without breaking down. It was such a remarkable achievement that many felt that the victory of democracy over totalitarianism was final. This victory has often been explained in terms of a fundamental advantage in information processing. Totalitarianism didn't work because trying to concentrate and process all the data in one central hub was extremely inefficient. At the beginning of the 21st century, it accordingly seemed that the future belonged to distributed information networks and to democracy. This turned out to be wrong. In fact, the next information revolution was already gathering momentum, setting the stage for a new round in the competition between democracy and totalitarianism. Computers, the internet, smartphones, social media, and AI posed new challenges to democracy, giving a voice not only to more disenfranchised groups, but to any human with an internet connection, and even to non-human agents. Democracies in the 2020s face the task, once again, of integrating a flood of new voices into the public conversation without destroying the social order. Things look as dire as they did in the 1960s, and there is no guarantee that democracies will pass the new test as successfully as they passed the previous one. Simultaneously, the new technologies also give fresh hope to totalitarian regimes that still dream of concentrating all the information in one hub. Yes, the old men on the podium in Red Square were not up to the task of orchestrating millions of lives from a single center. But perhaps AI can do it. As humankind enters the second quarter of the 21st century, a central question is how well democracies and totalitarian regimes will handle both the threats and the opportunities resulting from the current information revolution. Will the new technologies favor one type of regime over the other, or will we see the world divided once again, this time by a silicon curtain rather than an iron one? As in previous eras, information networks will struggle to find the right balance between truth and order. Some will opt to prioritize truth and maintain strong self-correcting mechanisms. Others will make the opposite choice. Many of the lessons learned from the canonization of the Bible, the early modern witch hunts and the Stalinist collectivization campaign will remain relevant and perhaps have to be relearned. However, the current information revolution also has some unique features, different from, and potentially far more dangerous than, anything we have seen before. Hitherto, every information network in history relied on human mythmakers and human bureaucrats to function. Clay tablets, papyrus rolls, printing presses, and radio sets have had a far-reaching impact on history, but it always remained the job of humans to compose all the texts, interpret the texts, and decide who would be burned as a witch or enslaved as a kulak. Now, however, humans will have to contend with digital mythmakers and digital bureaucrats. The main split in 21st century politics might not be between democracies and totalitarian regimes, but rather between human beings and non-human agents. Instead of dividing democracies from totalitarian regimes, a new silicon curtain may separate all humans from our unfathomable algorithmic overlords. People in all countries and walks of life, including even dictators, might find themselves subservient to an alien intelligence that can monitor everything we do while we have little idea what it is doing. The rest of this book, then, is dedicated to exploring whether such a silicon curtain is indeed descending on the world, and what life might look like when computers run our bureaucracies and algorithms invent new mythologies.